Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jonathan Blake, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 27th of August, these are our main stories. Open to agreement on Iran, President Trump says he has good feelings about a possible new deal with the country.
We're not looking for leadership change. We're looking for no nuclear weapons, no ballistic missiles, and a longer period of time. Very simple.
We'll assess what progress was made on that and the other big issues discussed by world leaders at the G7 summit. Kenya becomes the first East African country to export oil. Also in the podcast, find $500 million the drug maker Johnson & Johnson is ordered to pay out for its part in the US state of Oklahoma's opioid addiction crisis.
Increased rates of addiction, overdose deaths, and neonatal abstinence syndrome. The opioid crisis has ravaged the state of Oklahoma. It must be abated immediately.
And he defended dictators and was a pioneer in political advertising. A look back at the life of PR guru Tim Bell, who's died. We start in the French seaside town of Biarritz, where the G7 summit closed on Monday evening with a joint news conference by the host Emmanuel Macron and his American counterpart President Donald Trump. The two were warm in their appreciation of each other and spoke about a series of proposals on issues including world trade and digital taxation. But it was on Iran that President Macron made this announcement.
Given the two goals that we have, where are we going with this? We need to be sure that Iran will never get a nuclear weapon and that there will be no flare-ups in the region. And so what we discussed very concretely was to see how we could improve very considerably, or really, in fact, build a new nuclear agreement with Iran.
Emmanuel Macron went on to say that he had spoken to Iran's leaders and they, in principle, had agreed to consider talks with the United States. In response, President Trump outlined his position.
We're not looking for leadership change. This country has been through that many times before. That doesn't work. We're looking for no nuclear weapons, no ballistic missiles, and a longer period of time. Very simple. We can have it done in a very short period of time. And I really believe that Iran can be a great nation. I'd like to see that happen. But they can't have nuclear weapons.
So what should we make of President Macron's suggestion of a meeting between the presidents of Iran and the US? Well, here's our Middle East regional editor, Sebastian Usher, with this assessment.
I think there's definitely some progress. I think this can go down as a successful G7 summit for Emmanuel Macron, essentially, that from, you know, a very poor start, a sense that the Americans, the Europeans are very much at odds over so many issues, Iran being perhaps the key one, but he's managed to smooth over, at least get a sense that there's some momentum that's been reestablished. So both he and President Trump were speaking together of the possibility, the reality, in Mr. Trump's words, of a summit meeting between President Trump, President Rouhani of Iran, with Emmanuel Macron and other key signatories of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, from which, of course, Mr. Trump withdrew last year, reimposed sanctions, and has put us where we are now. So, you know, from that perspective, definitely there is some sense of progress. In terms of specifics, there is a French plan. Now, Mr. Trump didn't speak of that particularly, but he did, you know, not say no to the idea, for example, of a credit line being reestablished for Iran. What Iran is particularly concerned about at the moment is that it should have the ability to be selling oil again. US has been adopting a strategy of maximum pressure, which is essentially trying to reduce Iran's capacity to sell any oil to zero so that its economy completely, or it's already in a terrible state, but completely crumbles and makes the Iranians come begging to the table for some kind of deal. What is necessary, I think, obviously, in a situation like this, is that if there is any deal that can be done, any sort of nuanced way of working on this, both sides, Washington and Tehran, need to feel that they don't lose face over it. For Mr. Trump, you could see the way that Mr. Macron was handling him, he was very much aware of that. So he was very much giving a sense, this is Mr. Trump's deal, you know, it's his push. So, you know, that satisfied his sense of how things should be. With the Iranians, it's more complicated, because remember, one thing, even if there is a meeting with President Rouhani, Rouhani is not the be-all and end-all of authority in Iran by any means. There's the supreme leader, Ali Khamenei, and the powerful, much more conservative, much more anti-US, anti-the deal people around him, who've been very much given an extra initiative and sense of purpose about the failure of the proposal. So we're still a long way, but if we do get a summit, it will be a start. It will be very interesting how that works, and then how the deal can be done so that a deal still exists and both sides feel that they haven't lost and they've won to some extent in front of their own constituents and the world.
Sebastian Usher there. But Iran was only one of several issues being discussed at the summit. I asked our correspondent Hugh Schofield, who was in Biarritz, about those other issues, including the US president's view of fresh trade talks between the US and China.
He's on good form. He's on very upbeat form, Trump, at this summit. And I think on Iran and on China, he feels that his tactics, much criticised by some, are paying off. That being the tough guy, being prepared apparently to countenance, you know, blood and thunder, works, because it ends up with people coming round to talking. And just as, in his view, no doubt, Iran is doing that, he feels that China has also come to its senses because he's acted tough. So, you know, we had this apparent breakthrough this morning when he announced, President Trump announced that there'd been these calls overnight from the Chinese who are now willing to talk, wanting to get back to the table. And in his various comments made throughout the day, he sort of elaborated on that, saying they're doing it because they're in trouble, they're losing billions. We're fine in America. Yes, it's hitting us, but, you know, we're keeping inflation in check. The fallout of the tariffs is not significant, whereas they in China are suffering, so they want to come and talk. So for him, it's the natural outcome of what his policy was always intended to achieve, just this, that, you know, his adversaries would buckle before the new determination exhibited by him, Mr. Trump, and a very different kind of American policy from that of his predecessors, who he criticises much more than he criticises Iran or China. As far as he's concerned, they're acting out of their national interests, which he respects, but he's going to act out of his national interests, and that's what he's doing.
And Hugh, a quick word on how you'd reflect on the summit over the last couple of days. What was the atmosphere among the leaders, and how does it bode for cooperation between the G7 nations from now on?
Well, I would like to say that it bodes very, very well, because, I mean, there's no question that it's a very positive feeling at the end of it. I mean, you just have to see Trump's body language and his words. Oh, it was an incredible job, truly tremendous G7. He was praising Bridget Macron, and he was back to the early days of the Macron-Trump relationship when that bromance blossomed. It was clearly a very successful summit in that it was modest in its ambitions, it focused on the positive, the mood music was good, and there were these achievements which were modest.
Hugh Schofield in Biarritz. 7 years after oil was first discovered in the Turkana region of northern Kenya, the country's president, Uhuru Kenyatta, announced on Monday it had become the first East African country to export oil.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm proud to say Kenya's grand march to oil and gas production and export has now begun. The flagging off of this maiden consignment represents a new dawn, not just for Kenya, but also for our region, and the beginning of a new era of greater prosperity for all Kenyans.
Almost 250,000 barrels are being transported from the port of Mombasa in southern Kenya to the Far East in a test run before full production and exportation begins in around 5 years. The BBC's Africa business correspondent Hudaifa Aden is in Mombasa, and I asked him how significant this development was for the Kenyan economy.
It means so much for this country after oil was first discovered here in 2012 by Tullow Oil and its joint venture partners. So the current largest contributor of Kenyan revenue is tourism, followed closely by tea. But then again, oil would be able to become the second largest revenue generator for the economy, for as much as 1.5 billion being able to come from oil. That is when full production starts in 2024. But much more than anything else, this oil has been discovered in the northern part of Kenya, which is largely poverty-stricken part and which has largely been marginalized for so long. So the community is really excited about the benefits that they'd be able to reap from the oil that has been discovered in this part, because a revenue sharing mechanism that has been set by Kenyan Parliament through the Petroleum Act of 2019 gives them 5% of the total revenue share and 20% to the local county government of Turkana. So it means more jobs for them, it means better infrastructure for them, but much more than anything else, it means higher revenue for this country.
And just briefly, a word on the company that has won the right to buy the shipment of oil, a Chinese firm.
Yes, it's Chem China, which has secured the 240,000 barrels of the first shipment in this country. So 240,000 barrels for them, which would, of course, fetch the country as much as $18 million. So it really also shows the interest that the Chinese people and their government have in this specific part of Africa. But largely, much more than anything else, a number of analysts are informing me that it's a pointer to the debt repayment that the Kenyan government maybe is looking at, because China is the largest bilateral lender to Kenya.
Hudaifa Aden in Mombasa. Amnesty International has accused the Zimbabwean leader Emmerson Mnangagwa of presiding over a ruthless and systematic attack on human rights since he was sworn in as president a year ago. The human rights group said the president had resorted to what it called the same brutal tactics as his predecessor, Robert Mugabe. Grant Ferret reports.
When Emmerson Mnangagwa stood for election last year, he campaigned under the slogan, "Delivering the Zimbabwe You Want." 12 months on, the country is again mired in an economic crisis, characterised by raging inflation as well as severe shortages of fuel and water. Millions don't have enough to eat, partly because of drought. Amnesty International says protests against Mr. Mnangagwa have been violently suppressed. It says human rights activists have been abducted and tortured. The Zimbabwean president insists his government observes the rule of law and that he's open to dialogue.
You may not have heard of the British businessman Tim Bell, who has died at the age of 77, but millions around the world have been influenced by his work. As one of the UK's most sought-after PR consultants, Lord Bell, as he became, is said to have played a part in helping some of the world's most infamous dictators launder their reputations. The BBC's Manveen Rana investigated Lord Bell's ties to South African politics. She told me he could be considered one of the creators of the modern PR industry.
He once said to me in an interview there was no client he wouldn't take on. And as a result of that, he ended up with a long line of despots and dictators and the Pinochet Foundation, the Al-Assads. There are a number of controversial Russian oligarchs. During the Arab Spring, for example, he represented a number of the Middle Eastern governments who were facing protests.
As well as representing and defending those controversial leaders, he does seem to have achieved a reputation as something of a pioneer in terms of political messaging and political advertising.
Yes, so he really rose to prominence at Margaret Thatcher's side as her spin doctor. And he was supposed to be behind a big poster campaign which won her at the general election in 1979 and that first brought her to power. And Tim Bell went on to win 3 general elections for the Conservative Party. He ran their communications throughout. He was seen as a man who had a genius for understanding how to communicate a political message to the masses.
Having met the man, what do you think drove him to work with clients who some people might suggest were questionable and to be so successful over such a long period of time in so many different countries around the world?
Well, I think what drove the early part of his career was definitely ideology. He was very ideologically bound to Margaret Thatcher and very, very loyal throughout her life. But after that, and he was quite open about this, it was very much financial. When I asked him about ethical concerns about some of his clients, he admitted that the sort of ethical discussions they'd have when deciding whether they should take somebody on was whether they were so toxic they would lose them other business. When I sort of said, but what about the ethics? He would just laugh. You know, that he wasn't ashamed of the fact that it wasn't a business that was necessarily built on morals.
He left the company he set up, Bell Pottinger. What was it that led to his downfall professionally?
Well, he actually left after a period of illness. He had a stroke and was eased out of the company, I think, by some of his partners, which was something I don't think he forgave. But the company itself folded. It went into administration in 2017. And after a long list of controversies, the one that brought them down was actually a campaign they were doing in South Africa, which seemed to be on behalf of the controversial Gupta family, who were accused of mass corruption. It seemed to be inciting racial tensions across the country. And this is in post-apartheid South Africa, obviously a very sensitive issue. And we did a BBC investigation on it, which sort of contributed to the company folding. And I interviewed him during that process, and, you know, he did talk about it being his name over the door. So it wasn't a great moment to see the company he had built up, and it had become one of the biggest buccaneering PR firms in the world, to watch it fold. But at the same time, I think he wasn't entirely sorry that this was a controversy that brought them down.
Manveen Rana. Still to come in the podcast, how a Greek basketball player is widely tipped to shine at next week's World Basketball Championships in China. Now, though, the healthcare firm Johnson & Johnson has been ordered to pay over $500 million for fueling an opioid crisis in one US state. In the first ruling of its kind, Oklahoma Judge Thad Bolcom said prosecutors had demonstrated the firm contributed to a public nuisance in its deceptive promotion of highly addictive prescription painkillers.
Defendants caused an opioid crisis that is evidenced by increased rates of addiction, overdose deaths, and neonatal abstinence syndrome in Oklahoma. This is a temporary public nuisance that can be abated, and the proper remedy for public nuisance is equitable abatement. As I just stated, the opioid crisis has ravaged the state of Oklahoma. It must be abated immediately.
Our North America correspondent Peter Bowes told me more about what could prove to be a landmark case.
Well, the state of Oklahoma accused Johnson & Johnson of fueling the opioid epidemic, of acting like a drug kingpin and creating, as they described it, a public nuisance, one that cost the state billions of dollars and destroyed thousands of lives. Now, there is no denying that there is an opioid crisis in the United States. It's been estimated that 130 Americans have died every day over the past couple of decades through the use of these drugs. The state of Oklahoma argued that Johnson & Johnson had aggressively marketed opioids to doctors and patients as safe and effective, using, as they put it, misleading marketing campaigns to create an oversupply of addictive painkillers. Johnson & Johnson said it marketed its products appropriately, but clearly the judge disagreed, and his ruling is the first of its kind in this country to find an opioid manufacturer liable for the harm caused by these drugs.
And other drug companies may well be watching this closely. What could be the possible implications for the US in general?
Well, there are thousands of other lawsuits pending of a similar nature around the country, 40 other states pursuing similar lawsuits against pharmaceutical companies. And the significance of this is that this case in Oklahoma could provide a model for these upcoming lawsuits. Johnson & Johnson were convicted on the basis of being a public nuisance, and the lawyers representing other states now have a framework on which to base their own prosecutions, knowing that the arguments have succeeded in Oklahoma.
And any response in the immediate term from Johnson & Johnson to this ruling?
Yes, the company says that this is a flawed judgment in Oklahoma. They say they did not cause the opioid crisis. They say neither the facts nor the law support the outcome of this trial. And it says it is confident that it has strong grounds for appeal. It says the judgment disregards the company's compliance with federal and state laws, as it says, its unique role in promoting these medicines, the role that they play in the lives of people who need them. And it is clearly going to put up a strong defence in its appeal of this ruling.
Peter Bowes reporting. And staying in the United States, scientists there have discovered a way of modifying the widely used plastic polyurethane to make it far easier to recycle. The research was headed by Steve Zimmerman, professor of chemistry at the University of Illinois. He was asked what kind of materials were made from polyurethane.
Oh, it's an extremely large number of products that are made of polyurethane. So it's all kinds of foams, including the mattress foams you sleep on, elastomeric materials in shoes. Refrigerators have polyurethane foams.
And is it an unusually difficult thing to recycle?
It is, yeah. So it requires a lot of heat, often a catalyst. And even when you break it down, it's very hard to re-isolate the original monomers that make up the polymer.
So what has your team done that's new?
So what we've done is basically swap out one of the two components that industry uses to make polyurethanes, isocyanates and polyols. Those are the two that go together to make the polymeric material. So we've swapped out the one component, which is the polyol, so industry can continue to use the isocyanates that they're used to using. Our polyol contains this acetal linkage, which will break down with acid under very mild conditions.
And what can be made out of the breakdown products?
We've converted them into glues, and the one glue that we've made and tested actually is stronger than super glue.
So how practical would it be for industry to embrace this new technology of yours?
That's really hard for me to say because, I work in an academic lab. We know a number of industries that we've talked to are interested in it. One of the issues that we have to address is cost. Currently, the monomers that they use to make polymeric materials are very cheap, so we're working on making cheaper versions of our unit.
Presumably, if governments were really keen on a more recyclable form, they might subsidize it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, if there are regulations that guide the use of these materials, then people are going to have to find alternatives. So as long as they're able to scale up the polyol, maybe within a year or so, it could replace the existing processes.
Professor Steve Zimmerman talking to Paul Henley. Indonesia's president, Joko Widodo, has announced that the country's new capital will be built in the province of East Kalimantan on the island of Borneo. The current capital, Jakarta, is sinking due to subsidence. Environmental groups, though, have warned about damage to Borneo's wildlife. Endang Nurdin is from the BBC's Indonesian service.
Jakarta is facing many problems, overcrowding, worsening flooding, and by some measures, it is one of the fastest sinking city in the world. It's going to move to East Kalimantan province, combining two areas called North Penajam Pasir and Kutai Kartanegara. Environmentalists are worried about the rainforest and wildlife, and Kalimantan forest fires also occurs every year.
Mosquitoes communicate by vibrating their wings, especially when they want to find a mate. Now scientists in London want to use that knowledge to create more effective ways of killing them to help reduce the spread of malaria and yellow fever. Our science correspondent Palab Ghosh has this report.
For us, the sound is annoying, but for the mosquito, it's a love song. The buzz, made by its wing beats, helps the insects find mates and reproduce. Professor Jorg Albert of University College London is trying to learn the mosquito's language of love and so sabotage their mating cycle. This, he hopes, will slow the spread of deadly diseases, such as malaria and yellow fever.
For me, it's a sound of utter sophistication. We could simulate these sounds, use them perhaps for new technological devices to perform attraction of mosquitoes, to lure them away from sites where they can transmit disease, for example, from populations, from households, or also to catch them, kill them. So catch and kill devices could be designed, which are much more effective than the ones we're using right now.
By disrupting their communications, Professor Albert believes that eventually he can rid millions from the menace of the mosquito forever.
Now, later this week, the 18th Men's World Basketball Championship gets underway in China. As always, the United States will start as tournament favourites, but there'll also be plenty of interest in the Greek team. That's because their squad includes Giannis Antetokounmpo, who was voted best player in last season's American NBA. As Michael Innes reports, his rise to the top has been far from typical.
Giannis Antetokounmpo!
His combination of size, dexterity and athleticism have led to the nickname the Greek Freak. And his performances in the NBA this season have earned Giannis Antetokounmpo the accolade of most valuable player. In his tearful 5-minute acceptance speech, he thanked many people, his teammates, his late father and his devoted fans in Greece. But there was no mention of this man who spotted his very raw talent in the suburbs of the Greek capital.
My name is Spiros Veliniatis. I'm a basketball coach in Athens, Greece. We are right now at the Sepolia playground, the place where in 2007 I spotted Giannis.
Spiros Veliniatis is an unlikely basketball coach. Short and heavy set, he plays with amber worry beads throughout our conversation. but he clearly has an eye for a future sporting great, including the gangly son of illegal immigrants from Nigeria.
I saw Yanis, Kostas and Alex, the three younger ones, chasing each other. Because of my experience with African kids before, I could understand immediately that those kids were talented. You know, I said, God, am I seeing right?
Because he was so good.
No, they didn't play basketball. They were just chasing around. But I could understand by their movement that they had the highest potential possible in the world.
For the first 18 years of his life, Yanis couldn't claim Greek citizenship, despite being born there. Spiros tells me the family struggled to get by and often relied on Yanis and his brother to sell trinkets on the streets. So Spiros came up with a plan to lure him into a life of basketball.
I approached Yanis right here. I asked him, where do you come from? He said, I come from Nigeria. I said, what work does your parents do? He told me his mother was taking care of elder people. The father was driver. I said, if I find work for your parents with 800 euros, will you play basketball for me?
Mm-hmm. Almost a bribe, was it?
It is a bribe. But if you see Mozart with no food, will you give him a violin or a piece of bread? And the answer for me was a piece of bread.
The two men have had no contact for several years. Spiros says because a verbal agreement that he would get a cut of Yanis' first NBA contract wasn't honoured. So what did Spiros think when he saw his prodigy make an acceptance speech that didn't mention him?
I just was happy. I did not make a second thought of it. I was happy that he cried because he was a kid who could not cry. The violence and the harshness that he has seen had made him a very rough kid.
Spiros Feliniatis, ending that report by Michael Innes. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. And if you want to comment on this edition or the topics we've covered, you can send us an email. As ever, the address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Jonathan Blake. Until next time, goodbye.